You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Coming up next is Art Focus. Today's guest host is Portland artist Tom Kramer. He speaks with painter Lucinda Parker. Both Tom and Lucinda are represented by the Laura Russo Gallery in Portland.
Yes, this is Tom Kramer, and I'd first of all like to thank Julie Bernard for originally letting me host this show a long time ago. She is the founder of this show, and let's all give praise and thanks to Julie Bernard, and also, of course, to Ava Lake, who asked me to substitute this time. And today, we have a fantastically exciting guest. We have Lucinda Parker, the legendary, very highly esteemed Northwest painter, who's in here in the studio with me right now. Lucinda was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1942. She went on to go to Reed and the Museum Art School, graduated in 1966, and then went on to Pratt Institute in New York. And so, Lucinda, thank you so much for showing up.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate being invited.
In fact, I told a bunch of people that you were going to be my guest, and they couldn't believe that you agreed, and I'm flattered that, and the station should be flattered, too. It's great to have you in. Lucinda's had many, many, she's in collections all over the place, all over the country, all over the Northwest. And anyway, let's start out by sort of your background, Lucinda. You obviously got into art through, I imagine, very early on in your life. Why don't we talk about how you got into it, and obviously we'll talk about some of your teachers that were important to you.
I think I was very fortunate in my teachers. You're right, I started painting when I was about three. My mother let me paint on the kitchen table. How many mothers let you do that? I don't know.
That's right.
But anyway, and then when I was in grade school, maybe fifth, sixth grade, she had a friend who lived close to the school, and I would walk over to this friend's house. Her name was Barbara Gregory, and I used to, just me and her, she had been to art school, and she and I used to draw and paint together. And what I really remember about Barbara Gregory was she had a bunch of chickens in the backyard. And I used to sit with my manila paper and my poster paint, and I used to paint the chickens in different positions. So she would say, okay, they're going to move. So just, you know, here I was, I think probably I was in fifth grade, sixth grade. They're going to move, just paint them in one position. And if they move, just paint another version in the other position. So that was my first teacher. And I still have two of her paintings, and they're hanging in my kitchen as we speak. And she was a terrific teacher, but she was just a friend of the family. This was outside of Boston. And then my second teacher was in high school, Jerry Fole. My parents sent me to a boarding school when I was in 10th grade. I was kind of an antagonistic child. And there were five of us in the family, so I think they thought, let's get her out of here. But Jerry Fole was the teacher up at Putney, and I painted so much at Putney. I just painted all the time, plus we had two 3-hour classes a week. So I was painting in oils and drawing all the time. I didn't go to see a lot of stuff when I was young, but when I got older, I became totally enraptured by museums and by galleries and looking at paintings. But when I was a high school student, this will make you laugh, my favorite painter was Lionel Feininger.
Oh, right.
Whoever heard of Lionel Feininger?
The architectural
a German futurist.
Also a good photographer, too.
But it's so funny because your interest in different painters will change as you get older.
Right, and he's pretty tight. And one thing.
Very tight. But let's go back to my teacher a minute before we get off.
Then I know you went on to Reed.
I went to Reed. and my advisor was Lloyd Reynolds.
Right, well, everybody out there should know who he is, but he's an incredibly important. He was actually Steve Jobs' teacher at Reed. And taught it. I mean, Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen, all these people.
He was very involved.
Right, very involved with everything. Yeah.
He was really the art department, even though technically Reed didn't have an art department in those days.
Did you study calligraphy with him?
I studied calligraphy with him. Mm-hmm. I also took art history from him. And because he was my advisor, I got to go to his house and, you know, visit with him and his family. And so we got to be very close friends. And he was very encouraging about me going to the art school. And the other thing that happened when I got to Reed, it was 1960, and I had come across the country on a train And I'd never been west of Buffalo, New York.
Wow. What brought you to Reed? You want to comment
on
that?
Well, it was a very interesting thing. I grew up outside of Boston. There's lots and lots of colleges and universities in Boston. But no, I had to go 3,000 miles away from my family.
So you just wanted to get out of there.
No, I knew that Reed had a combined program with a museum school.
Right.
I knew about that.
Right.
And I had heard good things about Reed. So I said, let's do it.
Right.
My parents were really good natured about it. And I went by myself. You know, I never went to visit with anybody. I just went.
Right.
Sight unseen. Got off the train. I looked at the grass and I said to myself, this grass is too green.
Right.
It's so green compared to what New England looks like.
I know what you mean. Whenever I come back here, I realize how green it is.
It's so green. You know, it took me a long time to get readjusted because I was very involved with the color palette of New England. And so then my first teacher, besides Lloyd, was Manuel Esquerdo, because as I got to Reed, I called up the museum and I said, can I take a night class in life drawing? Before I was supposed to start the program. And they said, sure, you can. And so I got on the bus there at Reed. It takes you almost an hour. Get downtown. And Manuel was my first life drawing teacher.
He must have been great.
He was great. Yeah. He was great.
I actually had him, too, as a teacher. He was very tough.
Yeah.
You know,
well, he's a Mediterranean. Yeah. He had a European attitude towards craft and towards responsibility and work ethic, and a lot of those teachers didn't. And
I can kind of see the influence of his work on your work.
Yes,
there's kind of a muscular quality
to
both
of
your. I mean, I describe it as a muscular quality to your work.
I'm right with you there. I think it is.
Now, you don't mind if I skip around?
No,
a little
it's
bit,
fine.
All right. Well, I first became aware of Lucinda's work. You know, that famous art quake poster you did. I think in '78. I really liked that period of your work, and I was really attracted to it. And some of it was in the Robert Doughton collection. He had several of your paintings in his collection. And then alongside those paintings was, I remember, a guy named Ivan Morrison.
I remember
him.
I
don't
him
know
well.
If you know whether
I
he
knew
was
him.
An influence or whether you were an influence on each other.
Well, he was an action painter, and he then subsequently moved up to Seattle, and I sort of lost track with
him. Me too, but I liked his art.
He was a good painter, but I would say probably I'm more interested in structure.
Than he is, right.
Than he was.
Yeah, right.
And similarly for Milton Wilson, who was really, really a crazy, off-the-wall action painter.
Yeah.
But I'm more interested in structure, maybe, than those guys were.
I see.
But I don't know that I was aware of that then.
Right.
I got aware of it as I kept on working. I thought, I need...
What about de Kooning? Was he...
Totally nuts about de Kooning.
Yeah,
after
I could see
finding
that,
her, with finding her, I ended up at the art school and I started taking these books out of the library, and it was mostly de Kooning and Hans Hoffmann. And on the way out of the library, I'd look up and there was that C.S. Price hanging right there on top of the double door to the library. There was the C.S. Price of the Huckleberry Pickers. I used to look at that and I used to say, WPA, and I kind of snort. But now I just think that's a fabulous painting.
Yeah. C.S. Price is one of the greatest.
He's a great painter.
Northwest painters.
Yeah,
now,
really great painter.
Now, your last show, the show of Mount Hood, that everybody was pretty blown out by, everybody, including myself, it seemed almost an homage. You don't have to agree with me, but for me, my way of looking at it almost seemed like an homage to C.S. Price and kind of WPA or the kind of painting going on in, you know, in Germany at that time, you know, the kind of expressionism.
Well,
is there, and also one other question, I know it's a lot to throw out at you, but as I recall, your earlier 70s and even 80s work was largely brush, you know, done with a brush or poured, and then your recent work seems to be much more about a palette knife, you know, much more palette knife, much more almost sculptural, you know.
No, my early work was always like a big broom. I used a
okay,
broom.
Okay, I remember that. Right, okay. Now,
and it actually
you.
Was on the floor.
Let's talk about what material, your use of materials and how that relates to what you do and how that affects
your
work.
I want to go back to what you said about the homage.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, those paintings are an homage to earlier paintings. They're an homage to Charles Haney. They're an homage to C.S. Price.
How about Cézanne?
Cézanne, I feel so old-fashioned. I think it's so funny.
Right.
You know, and when I first came to Portland, you know, I used to go into people's houses that I didn't know and that didn't really collect art, but they always had a picture of Mount Hood. And I used to say to Steve on the way out, how come they have a picture of Mount Hood on the wall? It's right there where they can see it. I mean, can't they get a little bit more imaginative than that? And here I am. I'm totally fixated on it. I think it's very funny.
Well, there's there's a lot of power up there. I don't blame you.
Yeah, there's
you one
a lot
bit.
Of power.
I love Mount Hood. That there's whole area. A lot of power there's something about it. And the natives knew it. Why East? And
everybody knows it.
Yeah,
all you got to do is go up there and you think, oh my God, it blows your head off.
It does. And I could feel that in your pieces. Another reference I thought a little bit was Kirchner's, you know, yes. Ludwig Kirchner's paintings of the Swiss Alps in the 30s, a little bit of
yes,
that.
Yes, and I like Franz Marc, and I like Mackey. I like those guys. And I like early Kandinsky's because there are some mountain shapes in there, but they're also great paintings. The Kandinsky's are great paintings. And another artist that I like is Malevich, too.
Yeah, these
all the planes.
Very minimal, right?
Well, the early Malevich is minimal, but then he did all these fractured cubist paintings of peasants working.
Oh, right,
scissor grinders, and all those paintings. Those are not so minimal.
Well, it seems like one thing that's going on with your work is a combination of structure and obvious structure, interest in structure. You've just said that, but also improvisation or spontaneity. And that's what makes them very interesting. They're not just one thing. There's a sort of a combination of control and lack of control at the same time, which makes them, again, that's what makes art art. If it's only one thing, it's not very interesting.
Yeah.
And sort of a lack of predictability, especially in your last show.
Well, especially when you consider that the subject matter is the same. If the subject matter is always Mount Hood, how can you be unpredictable? However, there are a lot of ways to take apart that mountain and put it back together again. There are a lot of ways to see the shapes inside of it.
Now, that sounds cubistic to me.
Is cubism cubistic?
Is Picasso an influence also in Braque and those guys?
Yes, Picasso is, but people like Picabia.
Right, Picabia, right.
Those two paintings that the Modern Art Museum has in New York City, I always go and get down on my knees in front of those two paintings, those Picabia paintings, because there's no overall recognizable imagery in them, but the invention in the shapes. So my aim as a painter is, if I make a painting of Mount Hood, my job is to make the invention in the shapes inside of Mount Hood and in the clouds as good as I can, because I am really playing a new tune.
What I'm trying to say, right, is that your view of Mount Hood, one person that would handle it differently than you would be immediately, the French Impressionist like Monet would deal
totally
much
different.
More with, right, totally different. So I'm
totally
trying,
different.
Trying
I'm
to
talking
say
about shapes.
Did you think you're fundamentally,
shapes.
Right, a value-based painter rather
no,
than...
No, I think I'm both value and color. And so that's a funny combination, because most of the time you're supposed to be either one
right,
or the
right,
other.
Right, I understand that, right.
And furthermore, when you talk about shapes, you're supposed to be either gestural or shape. So what if I'm doing both shapes and gesture, and I'm doing both value and color.
Right.
That's what I'm doing.
Right. Well, Picabia, one thing that he did, I'm sure you're aware of this, but the work of his that really attracts me is where he would do like a still life painting, and then superimposed over the still life painting, he'd do a figure painting.
Now, that was a later Picabia.
That stuff is highly influential on Rosenquist.
And the
80s New York painting was really influenced
by
him
too. Right, that's later Picabia.
Right,
I like
this
earlier Picabia.
Is that, do you like the later too? Or
I
just
think
the
it's
earlier?
All right, but I like the earlier.
Right.
Because it's so jazzy.
Yeah.
You know, and I say jazzy, but I'm really interested in classical music. But I like the improvisation in jazz.
Speaking of classical music, I did think of a composer that is very much relates to what your last show was, to me, remind me about, and that would be Stravinsky, because Stravinsky, as you know, did very modern music early on, and then later in his career did neoclassical music, which sounds almost like Haydn or Mozart or earlier composers. And in a sense, that's what you were doing in your show. You were sort of revisiting an earlier style and doing something new with it, which I thought was a fantastic idea.
Well, you talked about retro, and I would say retro is too... I would say it's old-fashioned. Yes, it's really old-fashioned.
What do you mean by old-fashioned?
Looking back and not being ashamed of it.
Okay, well, that's...
Retro is tongue-in-cheek, but old-fashioned is, you know, those are good paintings. I just want to go back and see if I can get what Courbet had and stick it into a cubist version of Mount Hood or Cézanne, you know.
Right.
Or I'm trying to take a little tiny chip of genius out of Kandinsky. You know, I'm just trying to get... It's like you get inspired by your friends and your gallery mates, and you get inspired by nature, but you also get inspired by older paintings.
That's right.
And I learned early on that if I got low, which happens sometimes, I would pick up a really good biography of a great painter or a great sculptor, and I would read it. And I just now read a wonderful biography of Cézanne called Cézanne, A Life by Alex Danchef, D-A-N-C-H-E-F, a great big monster book. And I read it, and I was totally enthralled with it. And then I got finished with it, and I put it aside, and I told some friends, read this. And then I was working on a project with Susan Banyas, called
dance
the Blue
Person, right?
Yeah, the dance person, called the Blue Wheel, and she had me doing a monologue about blue, and so we were quoting some things from that book, because there's a lot of talk about how Cézanne liked to draw in blue, and how he wanted a sufficient amount of bluishness in order to give the feeling of depth. Well, finding those quotes, I started the beginning of the book and read the whole damn thing again, and I thought, this is very funny, but it was like, it was very nourishing.
Is biography one of your favorite things to read?
I like everything, but...
I know that you just mentioned a book, so is reading an important influence
on
your work?
Yes, reading is important in a lot of ways, because partly because I like to read. I always have liked to read. Mm-hmm. Partly because I don't have a computer. I don't have a TV.
Good for you.
I don't have a microwave. Maybe I should get a microwave, but I don't have any of those other things.
Is that a deliberate decision or just
Yes, you just never got one? It was a deliberate decision.
Are you sort of a Luddite in some ways?
Well, some ways, yeah. Steve and I, when we got married 44, 45 years ago, we both said to each other, we don't want the TV. And his reasoning was, well, it's so upsetting to watch the TV. I'd rather get my news in the paper so I can digest it more slowly.
Right.
My reasoning was, I don't want to pollute all my visual feelings with the stuff in the TV. Now, I know there are a lot of artists that go the opposite way. They go towards popular culture.
Right.
And for some funny reason, I never was steeped in it to begin with.
This is an interesting question. I want to bring this up. Now, are you actively rejecting pop culture?
Not really. Not really. I like what artists do with it.
Because obviously you're born around the same time as, you know, the Beatles.
I grew up in a household. Yeah. My mother was a violin teacher. I studied the violin, and we didn't have a radio on. And I heard music all the time in the house that was really being played. And then I went away to school, and nobody there had a radio. And so I kind of...
Fantastic.
I sort of missed out on that stuff. And then I sort of belatedly got interested in Elvis.
You know, Elvis Presley, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, Elvis and all those guys. I mean, I'm interested in it now. I think pop culture has a huge role to play, because you cannot have so-called elitist ideas without crashing up against some of the popular things. It always happens. Folk art. Look at Kandinsky when he started work.
Right.
He started work. He grew up in Moscow, and he was working for the tax collector, and he would go out into the country, and he would go into these peasant houses and these country places, and he said, they're all painted red and yellow and orange inside. Everything in there was red and orange. He said, it was fantastic. It was like, that was popular culture in those days.
Exactly. Now, do you think it's always been, I mean, it's a kind of a dumb question, but popular culture, the high and low, you remember that show at the Museum of Modern Art?
Yes, I do.
I saw it. Is that an idea that's always been with us, or is it unique to recent modern times in your
view?
When you look at Hogarth.
Yeah, but those are all pre-industrial. We're talking about post-industrial pop art. And post-industrial popular art is at the service of the corporations that hire those guys. I mean, I'm not talking about the musicians, but I'm talking about people who do commercial design, the people that design the cereal boxes. Those people that is maybe commercial art, and it is very influential.
I agree with you.
It's very influential, both in terms of inadvertently making little kids want to buy cereal, but also those designers are really good at what they do.
Now, don't you think that, like, Warhol's 50s work, where he was an ad guy, influenced
I absolutely do. You know, and then you have Lichtenstein, the same thing, you know?
Right.
I think I used to copy the comics when I was a little girl. You know, we didn't watch a lot of TV because it was sort of back in the black and white days of TV. But I used to lie down on my tummy and on the floor and with a whole page of comics and try and copy Al Capp or try and copy Walt Kelly to Pogo. I did that. It's just not in my paintings, you know.
We just brought up the high-low relationships. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about other relationships that come up in your work. One thing that is pops up a lot in your work is there's a sort of a continuum address between abstraction and recognizable aspects of nature. Okay.
Yes.
And so, can you talk about that?
I would like to talk about that because on the face of it, there's not a lot of abstraction in nature. There's not a lot of abstraction when you just look at pictorial nature, when you're out there looking. However, our perceptions of nature, I think, are very much defined by what I would call the vertical and horizontal way we look at things. So if you draw a line right down the face, from the forehead down the nose through the middle of the mouth to the chin, that's a vertical. And then you draw a line through the eyes, and that's a horizontal. And as soon as you tip your head, it's off kilter, but it's still there. And so when you go to the ocean and you're looking at the horizon, you're looking at a fantastically abstract line, that horizon, and it's right there at your eye level. So we are inadvertently or unknowingly carrying around a matrix. And most of us don't think about it, but people who teach art and make art think about it all the time.
Right.
Because if you're trying to teach a student how to draw, you have to show them that matrix and get them to see it and to see where things are against it. And so that's abstract.
Right.
And anybody who's had a background as a painter knows that everything that you look at is a shape. And as soon as you know what it is, then you forget that it's a shape. But if you're an artist, you never forget that it's a shape.
Right.
You never forget that thing you're looking at has shapes in it. And another thing I think that's in nature that is abstract is geometry. We don't think of geometry in nature, but let's start with the sun. It's round. It's a circle.
Right.
Let's start with our eyes and how we see each, our eyes and the iris in there that's a perfect circle.
Right.
Let's think about you're sitting by a pond and a little bit of water is falling out of the air, drips of rain. And what happens? Concentric circles. So you don't think that primitive man saw that, primitive woman?
Isn't that amazing?
I think they did see it.
Isn't that amazing?
They were really interested in it. In Australia, 90,000 years ago, there were people in Australia making concentric circles on the cliffs. They had some meaning. They knew what they meant. We don't know what they meant, but they knew what they meant. Concentric circles. That's abstract.
Yeah. I just read, I think it was Robert Ryman, book on him, and he said that how would you paint a photo representational painting of an all blue sky? And obviously the answer is an all blue painting.
Exactly.
So he was making the same point in a more extreme way.
Yeah.
You could also almost argue what you just got through saying is that you could argue everything is either representational or everything is abstract, depending on how you use your verbiage. Isn't that
well,
sort of right?
Well, no, I mean, because some things I think are very tied to the photograph.
Well, let me just cover
that's real, a different thing.
Well, here's something that's interesting, though. I mean, look at bark on a tree, the pattern
of
bark.
Yeah, that's
very... Okay, that can be very almost...
Abstract.
It seems random, but when you look at it, it makes sense, you know, just
yes.
like patterns in the sand.
Well, we recognize it.
That's right.
So the other thing is we recognize a lot of these things because we've been living in this world for a long time.
Right.
So as soon as you take your historical sense about what things are and you set it aside and you just look at it, which is what artists do, there's a lot of stuff there.
Well, I think what's interesting about your work and what we're talking about is that it addresses or brings up or calls to attention to these amazing issues, which is the relationship between those seemingly unrelated things, which are in fact very much related, right? Now, I wanted to talk a little bit. I guess you've sort of answered it. It does not sound like the so-called, you know, Woodstock generation and all that happened in the wild 60s were a big influence on you necessarily.
When I was in high school, I read Walt Whitman.
Well, he's a big influence on
me. I know,
but
he was an influence on me, but I wasn't influenced by the people that were influenced by him. I was influenced by him.
Because, you know, obviously you went to Reed College, and Reed College is cited as one of the major countercultural centers in the United States, including, you know, Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen and all that.
But I didn't know those guys. I knew Lloyd, who was their teacher, which is kind of ironic, you know. And I knew Manuel, who was
kind of like that.
And Louis Bunce, who was kind of like that. And George Johanson, who, you know, all those people were my teachers, and Mel Katz.
Would you say that this scene used to be sort of friendlier than it is now? I mean, was it back then, you mentioned all these people, is it like they were friends?
Not always. There was always some competition.
I mean, how has the scene changed? What's it like being an artist in Portland?
It's so much bigger. There's so many more artists. There's so many more galleries. And it's so healthy to have so many more galleries, because at the very beginning in 1962 or 3, Arlene opened a gallery and Jack McLarty and Barbara McLarty opened a gallery. It was almost simultaneously two galleries at once. They could not have been more different from each other. And Jack made some amazingly sardonic prints in which he showed the people who were showing at Arlene's gallery as being grasping after money. And mm-hmm. and there were specific portraits of people that were in this print. It was really, he was really angry.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a very good artist, and I always admired what he did. But they were showing in their front living room. And Arlene had a whole other idea.
Right.
And so the two worked back and forth, and there was some friction there. But it's much better to have 5 or 6 or 7 galleries and a lot more painters and a lot more sculptors and people doing all kinds of other kinds of things, you know?
Yeah.
Much better.
Do you follow many of the galleries around town, or do you have to limit?
I do not follow, but I do go.
Right.
I do not follow, but I go when I see something I think I want to see.
Okay, here's another.
Like, I went to see Eva Lake's collages.
Yeah, it was a nice
show.
They
were fabulous.
It was a great show.
But I went purposely because I was interested in them.
Right. Okay, here's another large question. I don't mean to throw this on you, but do you think there's a major difference between the art around this area and the art, you know, like in New York or California or whatever?
Well, remember, I went to graduate school in Brooklyn, so I have some feeling for what it was like there.
Would your work be different if you lived in a different...
I have no
idea. You don't know?
Okay,
all right.
I have no idea. I've often wondered because it's true that you are affected by where you live, and particularly painters are. I really believe that painters are maybe more affected by where they live than almost any other of the art forms, although writers are too affected by where they live. But anyway, back to what it's like here. Think of it as a huge river and we're in an eddy.
Mm-hmm.
And the eddy is going round and round, and there's new water coming in and there's old water going out, and mm-hmm. there's all kinds of nutrients in there, but it's slower. It's a little quieter. It's not quite so crazy.
Right.
It's a different... Eddies are part of the system, the hydraulic system of a river, but they're a little off to the side.
Do you ever like to go to bigger scenes to
I go to museums. I go to museums as many times as I can. Wherever I go, I go to a museum.
All right, now.
And to galleries, whatever I can get to.
Are there any other art forms, mainly besides painting and drawing, i.e. visual art, that you have a great interest in music, classical music, and you perform, don't you?
I don't perform, but I have sung for many years. I used to sing with John Bunce, Louis Bunce's son.
Okay.
And
talk about briefly, we're running out of time, but the influence of music on your
work. Music
is
rhythmic and music is bold. And I really like Shostakovich. I like Stravinsky. I like Bartok.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like Brahms,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I like Vivaldi. But I like this whole rhythmic propulsion of ideas. And to me, that's related to how I paint.
I see.
Rhythm.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
I mean, most people who do music, they don't get that there's rhythm in paintings. Most people who do paintings don't get that there's color in music, which is kind of ironic, because people in music will talk about color, tone color, and people in painting will talk about rhythm.
Isn't that true?
It's true. There's a lot of rhythm.
I've always thought that the relationship between music and visual art is incredibly close. And
very close.
Yeah, very close.
Very close.
You know, unfortunately, we're going to have to end this interview. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. But I want to thank you so much for coming on, Lucinda.
It was my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
I like having somebody ask me questions, because then I get to talk.
Well, you're really fun to interview because you are, everything you say is incredibly interesting, and you open up a bunch of great things for people to think about. This is Tom Kramer. I've been talking with Lucinda Parker. Thank you, Eva Lake. Thank you, Julie Bernard, for starting this show. This is Tom Kramer, KBOO. Thank you very much. Support KBOO if you can.
That was artist Tom Kramer, guest hosting Art Focus today. His guest was Portland painter Lucinda Parker. Both Lucinda and Tom are represented by the Laura Russo Gallery in Portland. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting Moody Blues guitarist Justin Hayward with Mike Dawes, Tuesday, June 10th. Tickets and information for Justin Hayward, June 10th at Aladdin-Theater.com.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KABOO Portland.
A Chinese government agency has called out the U.S.'s National Security Agency for its unscrupulous surveillance operations. China's report found that the NSA had hacked into Chinese businesses, primarily computer servers in the telecommunications company Huawei, as well as servers at China's top university. The report states that the U.S. has been using spy tactics which go way beyond what is deemed within reason in anti-terrorist pursuits. According to China's report, the U.S. is using cyber espionage under a veil of fighting terrorism when its operations are in fact violating human rights and breaking international laws. 30 Greenpeace activists occupied a Russian oil rig this morning in a Dutch port for 5 hours before being detained. 6 activists have been arrested. Simultaneously, 15 activists are currently occupying an oil rig owned by the Norwegian company Statoil. These occupations are acts of protest against the commercialization of the Arctic Circle and the degradation of the environment due to oil drilling. With recent evidence of the Arctic Circle's ice melting at a much more startling rate than initially predicted, activists feel these oil companies' plans to drill in the Arctic Circle threatens our global safety.
Muy buenas tardes. Estás escuchando KBOO Portland. A continuación, un corte informativo en español. Anuncia